It's basically 10 dB. May have to tweak a little bit, but I don't have that 4 dB secondary signal.
Now, you haven't yet told me what is the res bandwidth. How is the control set on the spectrum analyzer? Maybe it's automatically selecting, but what is the res bandwidth while you're making this observation?
Oh, that's what I'm not sure of, Dick. I know it is set in the automatic mode, and I have the total sweep 0 to 500 megahertz. I'm sure the resolution bandwidth.
And most likely you're probably making something like 30 sweeps per second. In other words, there's not very much flicker on screen. 0 to 500 megs at a 30-second sweep. My guess is the analyzer is automatically selecting either the 300 KC or the 1 megacycle filter. Does that sound reasonable? In fact, if the machine is in front of you, you can set it that way right now, and you'd be able to tell me where it automatically sets its res bandwidth. Over to you, John.
I'm not in the lab. I'm in the ham shack, which is the other part of the lab, so I don't know. But it is in the 100 KC range, so 300 KC it might be. It's definitely not up in the megahertz range.
Okay, it's probably, I think it's more likely to be 300 KC when you're sweeping 500 megs. That's a reasonably fast bandwidth. And it's sweeping, you don't see a slow sweep. You see it almost flicker-free on screen. Is that true, John?
Absolutely, flicker-free. Absolutely.
And you're not using any kind of video storage on the spectrum analyzer screen?
No, no, real time.
By the way, what is the model number of the spectrum analyzer?
A large one. 8668?
Could it be 8566?
No, maybe 8560.
Okay. The spectrum analyzer itself goes from what frequency to what frequency? What's the highest end it goes to?
31 gig.
31 gig directly or with external mixers?
No, it's self-contained. No external.
Very nice machine. Wow. Boy, you equipped. Okay. I'm going to assume it's something like if it was a 100 KC filter, and I'm assuming now you're not using an RF preamplifier, because I think that particular machine, is there an RF preamplifier you can turn on that first band?
Negative, just a normal attenuator. Using no other equipment other than a straight spectrum analyzer.
Okay. A usual spectrum analyzer in the 1 meg res bandwidth on the most sensitive band, which is the 2 to 4 gigs, noise on the screen is around minus 85. You've got another mixer front end when you're using the band 1 mixer, minus 90. Ratio from noise of minus 90, it's minus 80 after the directional coupler, 20 dB coupler, it's around minus 60, minus 55. Does it seem like the signal generator might be set at minus 55 dBm? In other words, you're nowhere near the max power out of that signal generator. You're in the middle of its range, getting closer to the bottom. Does that seem about right, John? Go ahead.
Yes, that's right, Dick, because like I said, I only need enough signal to get a usable waveform. I find that's my best rule to follow. Second of all, I'm in the first position of the frequency range of the generator, which is from 0 to 1.7 gig.
And as I said, that's the one with the mixer front end. And because the mixer does allow some of the signal to come flowing back out of the spectrum analyzer, very few people doing a very sensitive test, sometimes you can be fooled by that. Now, this spurious signal that you're seeing at roughly 304 megacycles, 79 megahertz higher than the 225 where you're running the test, when you start moving dials and observe what happens, boy, that can give you a lot of hints. In other words, if you took the 225 megacycles and move it on the Gigatronics to 226, jump up one megacycle. Does the spurious signal at 304 move one megacycle? One megacycle up, one megacycle down, two megacycles up or down, three megacycles up or down? How fast it moves in frequency is a strong clue. Second of all, if you change the amplitude, it's too bad you don't have more than 10 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. In fact, you could. you could crank up the signal generator by exactly 10 dB. You crank up the signal generator by 10 dB, so that now the signal on the screen is not 10 dB above the noise, but 20 dB above the noise. Does the spurious signal also move exactly 10 dB? Does it move 20 dB? Does it move 30 dB? So changing amplitude, how fast does the spur move in relationship? Changing frequency, how fast does it move? And I think you're being ultra-conservative, John. Let me drop. We've all run into the problem when you put too strong a signal into the signal into the spectrum analyzer. The spectrum analyzer itself will start making some phony signals. Most self-respecting, properly operating spectrum analyzers will not do that until the signal getting to the front panel is approximately minus 25 dBm. You've got a signal going into the front panel, it's around minus 55 dBm. You've got another 30 dB to go, so to speak. So I think you're being ultra-conservative by making the signal that weak. Therefore, if you jump up 10 dB in signal strength, what does the spur do? If you move 1 megacycle or 10 megacycle in frequencies, what does the spur do? Because each of the methods of generating a spurious signal, be it a 2x1 product, a 3x2 product, a 4x3 product, each of these individual products obey some rather strict rules of frequency deviation and amplitude deviation. Most likely, the spurious signal you're seeing is due to some kind of nonlinearity. Now, who's doing the nonlinearity? Let me drop. By moving amplitude and frequency of signal generator, that's a strong clue. When you jump up 10 dB on the signal generator, and let me choose the worst situation. The worst situation, whereas you go up 10 dB on the signal generator, the real signal, which was 10 dB above the noise, is now 20 dB above the noise. The spurious signal that used to be 4 dB above the noise is now 14 dB above the noise. That's the worst case situation for which everything moved in a linear manner. It'll drive you crazy because almost all of these usual spurious generating techniques are a nonlinear function somewhere. So therefore, something is not going to track. Frequency is not going to track, amplitude is going to track. But you're going to go up 10 dB on the signal generator. And in the worst case situation, everything moves linear. At first, it drives you crazy. Now you've only moved frequency and amplitude on signal generator. If your particular spectrum analyzer does have on its front panel an RF attenuator that you can add, and you crank in 10 decibels of more RF attenuation, because of the automatic functions on modern-day spectrum analyzers, sometimes when you try to crank in 10 more dB of RF attenuation, the machine is so damn busy making sure everything stays calibrated the same way at the top of the screen that they crank in 10 dB more RF attenuation, but then they crank in 10 dB of more gain in the IF strip in order to make everything come out the same amplitude cal. And so two things are changing at once, and it drives you crazy. What I've had to do on a number of occasions is I want 10 dB of more RF attenuation only. I want nothing else to change. And I've had to plug in an external 10 dB pad on the front panel of the spectrum analyzer to make that happen in order to figure out what's going on. But here's my point. If you could now, after going up 10 dB on the SigGen, and everything worst case moved up by 10, you've now got a 20 and a 14, and you plug in 10 decibels of more
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You plug in 10 dB of more RF attenuation in front of the spectrum analyzer. If the spectrum analyzer is telling you the truth, every single signal on that screen better move down exactly 10 decibels. If any signal on that screen moves by any other ratio, when you plug in pure RF 10 dB of attenuation on the front panel, now you've got to be suspicious of the spectrum analyzer. So right now you want to know who's doing it. Is it the coupler? Is it the SIG generator? Is it the spectrum analyzer? You've done a hell of a lot of testing that seems to eliminate all of those, except for the Alford versus the Mac brand. Now, if Alford is doing it, and Mac doesn't do it, and maybe you've got a third brand that doesn't do it, it does suggest that somebody has got a very flaky contact, take that Alford and start tapping on it with a radio mallet, if you know what I mean. Pick up a screwdriver, the back end of a screwdriver, the wooden end, and slam it against the directional coupler and see if you can make anything change. Is there a hidden detecting diode in there that doesn't show because there's another port or whatever. You see some of the things that I'm suspicious of here. I'm giving you a whole bunch of hints as to what testing to do to find out who's the bad guy. KC2WGB, beautiful mystery you got here, John. K2RIW in the tech net. It can't be happening, John. You just think it's happening.
Yeah, my old eyes are fooling me, Dick. Also, I did try one test that you just recommended. I moved my frequency of the generator up from 225 to 226. I brought it up 1 megahertz. That secondary blip only went up one-tenth of that frequency, according to my markers. So it seems to be a 1-to-10 ratio there. On amplitude, they don't seem to follow linear. I don't know the dB readings because I just increased the gain slightly and brought it down. But that's a good suggestion. I'm going to try an external attenuator outside of the attenuator on the unit because you're right. If I bring it down, the unit will bring it back up trying to keep the consistent display. But that 1 to 10 bothers me. I have no reason why it does that. Really frequent. It's the Mac that's doing it. The Alfred is not showing the same problem. So this is really, really driving me nuts. And it has like 40 screws on this thing. I could take it apart and start probing it after I whack it around with the screwdriver. But I didn't want to take it apart. Not that it's not a valuable piece. I think it only cost me $20. But I am going to try that.
Don't contaminate the test. Leave it as is. Whack it with a screwdriver, the back end, the wooden end of the screwdriver. On all six corners, on all six sides, if you know what I mean. The fact that you moved it up 1 megacycle and it moved a tenth of a megacycle, wow, that's a strong piece of evidence. That's a strong piece of evidence that somewhere the tenth harmonic is happening. And let me think now, moving 1/10, wow. It is not the harmonic out of the SIG generator. It would have to move linearly. You move up 1 megacycle. If it was the second harmonic out of the SIG gen, it would have to move 2 megacycles to move a fraction of the frequency out of the SIG gen is out of the question. That can't happen. Right now, I'm becoming suspicious of your spectrum analyzer, not liking the particular load it sees on that particular Alford directional coupler. Moving 1/10. Wow.
Spectrum analyzers are showing the same thing, Dick.
Yeah, it turns out that both spectrum analyzers in the first band have a mixer front end, and therefore they're both re-radiating some local oscillator coming out of that input connector. And I think we'll have to discuss is how much. So there's another complicating factor here. And depending on the directivity of the Alford determines how much of the signal coming out of the spectrum analyzer is now being reflected into the output port of the Gigatronics. So local oscillator squirting out of signal generator, out of the spectrum analyzer, bouncing off of the Gigatronics is a possible factor. And some filtering in there might confirm that. But this 1/10, the SIG gen can't do that. No, not a 1/10 phenomenon. Well, let me track that. Let me back up on that a little bit. The Gigatronics is a so-called indirect frequency synthesizer, indirect phase-lock loop type, spectrum analyzer. Single generator is the one where there's a bunch of comb generators and a bunch of filters that mix the right comb line together in order to get the right frequency. A signal generator that uses phase-lock loops and fractional divide circuits, that's called an indirect synthesizer. And they can do some funny things. So I've got to be careful on that one. Let me drop in something else I want to tell you. Yeah, so directivity of the coupler could be a factor. Oh, when you get that signal at 304 megacycles, have you ever tried zooming in on the 304? When you zoom in on it, in other words, you set that in the center of the screen and you go to smaller and smaller scan width and you look at that signal. And as you do that, the automatic controls of the spectrum analyzer will automatically select a smaller and smaller resolution bandwidth. Therefore, the net result will be that the signal will become more and more out of the noise. And now, as that happens, as you go to more narrow scan width, and you see the signal more out of the noise, not changing in amplitude absolute, but the noise is going down because of the more narrow filter, does the signal look like a pure sine wave, one simple line to it, or does it have multiple lines as you start zooming in on it? I wonder if you tried zooming in on that spurious signal. Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I did not have the forethought to do that. Ah, that's something I should have done. All I notice is the Q on that is very sharp compared to the primary signal. Second question I was going to ask you, would there be any point to putting the two couplers in series and looking at the output of both couplers to see if it's carried through?
Oh, back up. You said a mouthful. You didn't realize it. You said the Q is very sharp. Whoa, back up. You're telling me the apparent bandwidth on the display screen of the 225 megacycle signal looked appropriate for a, let's say, 100 kc or 300 kc res bandwidth.
Correct.
But the spurious signal looked much, much sharper. Is that what you said?
Yes, I'd say about 50% for it.
Whoa, you said a mouthful. There is no way in hell that a pure signal at 304 megacycles can suddenly display itself as if you were using a more narrow resolution bandwidth. In other words, as your spectrum analyzer was scanning 0 to 500 megs, as it scanned across 225 meg, you were seeing the apparent width of the signal, which is appropriate for the 100 kc res bandwidth that the machine had automatically selected. And nobody suddenly switched that filter. Your analyzer, your spectrum analyzer, kept on sweeping. I'm looking at, 30 sweeps per second, we'll say, and I'm looking at one particular sweep, and I'm looking at it 1 millimeter at a time. I've watched it sweep across. I've slowed down time in order to figure out what's going on. I got a high-speed camera, and I'm now using slow-motion photography, if you know what I mean. As the signal swept across 225 megs, I saw the normal bandwidth of a 100 kc filter. And that spectrum analyzer kept on sweeping. Nobody changed anything. As it swept across the 304, it's as if somebody has suddenly switched in a more narrow filter. No way in hell. You didn't do that without some very special programming. The analyzer cannot do that. The fact that you saw a more narrow signal that moves at one-tenth the speed tells me it is the spectrum analyzer. And that tells me that the local oscillator, the harmonic of the local oscillator, squirting out of the front panel of the spectrum analyzer, bouncing off of the gigatronics, because your particular Alfred coupler has a slightly different number of decibels of directivity. They both have 20 dB of coupling. The Mac might have 30 decibels of directivity. It's better than spec.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The Alfred might have of 18 dB of directivity, and maybe the spec is 18. It's in spec, but there could be, in my example, 12 decibels of difference in directivity. They both have 20 dB of coupling, but the directivity at the frequency coming out of the spectrum analyzer, the directivity at that frequency, we haven't figured out which one it is yet. I mean, when you're scanning through 304 megs, the spectrum analyzer might really have a local oscillator that is 1.7 gigahertz higher. It's really scanning through roughly 2 gigahertz. And the umpty-umpt harmonic of 2 gigahertz is squirting out of the front panel of the spectrum analyzer. At that frequency, 2 gigs, the directional coupler doesn't have any guarantee of its directivity. You get what happens, if you know what I mean. And now that signal reflects off the output circuit of the gigatronics and does something funny. That's a possibility. Strongly suggest that the local oscillator re-radiating out of the front panel of the spectrum analyzer is a clue. And as you plug in a 10 decibel RF attenuator on the front panel of the spectrum analyzer, you may see that change in some very crazy nonlinear ways. And you'll have to go up 10 dB stronger on the SIGGEN in order to do that. As you start zeroing in on this, you're going to start saying all kinds of funny things. Had you zoomed in on that signal, boy, you would have seen some really strange things scanned with bandwidth-wise, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, that's very interesting, and it gives me some directivity on which way to look at this. My other question was, if I put two of those couplers in series, the Mac is the one that's showing me. I look at both of the output ports on the coupling ports. What do you think I'm going to see? I haven't done it yet.
If my speculation is correct, and if you start off from Gigatronics through a cable, go into the output first, go into the Mac second, then go into the dummy load. When you do it that way, at the time you're connected to the Mac, I think you're going to see essentially the same phenomenon. If you go into the Alfred, you're not going to see it. There's a slight catch, and that is the directivity you get out of a coupler is not only a function of how well tuned the coupler is tuned for directivity. It's strongly affected by the exact impedance the straight through line on the coupler sees. Here's my example. I can start off with a directional coupler that has mediocre performance. 15 dB of directivity, 10 dB of coupling coefficient. That's a medium performance, mediocre performance. 10 dB of coupling coefficient, 15 dB of directivity. You allow me to put a double stub tuner or a double slug tuner between the output port of the directional coupler and your 50-ohm dummy load. You allow me to adjust the controls on that double stub tuner. In other words, I'm making the 50-ohm load look a little bit different than 50 ohms. I may make it look like 48 ohms of resistance with 10 ohms of capacitive reactance. I'm just retuning it a little bit. But what I'm doing is I'm taking some of the signal that should have gone to the dummy load, and I'm reflecting it back to the coupler, and I'm reflecting it back to the coupler with exactly the right amplitude and phase angle, so that's 180 degrees out of phase with the poor directivity.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
A coupler that has mediocre directivity really means it's allowing a little bit of the signal in the wrong direction to sneak through onto the coupled port. But if I can supply it a second signal to that coupled port that's 180 degrees out of phase and exactly the same amplitude, I'll get cancellation. So if my favorite frequency for measurement is 225, and I adjust this directional coupler while doing the testing at 225, I can make your 15 dB directivity coupler become 40 decibels of directivity at that frequency. I can now proceed on putting unknown loads after the double stub tuner. In other words, take out the 50 ohm dummy load and put in anything I want to measure, and I will be making measurements at that frequency, 225. I'll be making measurements of 40 decibels of directivity. I can force the directivity to be perfect by making a slight disturbance on what it sees in the output. Once you take the Alfred that used to go directly to the dummy load and is now going to go to the Mac and then the dummy load, and because the Mac is good but not perfect, it's not exactly 50 ohms, you can see it's going to change the directivity a little bit. So there's going to be some change, but I still think you're going to get primarily repetition when you put the two cascaded. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, KC2WGB, just to see if my brain is following you. If I were to just use the Mac, take the Gigatronic, pump it in as I usually do, look at the output port, and then change the 50-ohm termination to a 75-ohm termination, my main waveform is going to stay basically in the same position. Do you think the other one is going to move?
Well, when you say the other one moved, with the Mac, there was no 304. If there is no 304, how can it move? So I misunderstood the question. Go ahead.
Oh, no, the Mac is the one with the problem. The Alpha's working perfectly. It's the Mac. So if I use the Mac and use two different terminations, 150 and 170, 75, do you think that's going to change that reflection coefficient enough to move that if it's a spurious signal or a signal that's bouncing back due to the directed coupling?
Now, there's no good answer to that one, John, because you're taking a shot in the dark. Does the directivity improve with 50 versus 70 ohms? I don't know. If you had a double stub tuner, a double slug tuner, if you had any kind of a tuning device that operates on a 50 ohm line, and you put it on the output of the Mac into the 50 ohm load, and you adjust the controls on it, I'm almost positive you're going to see the 304 go up and down as you adjust those controls. But a simple test of jumping from 50 ohm load to 70 ohm load, I think it's going to change, but I wouldn't guarantee it. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, well, at least you've given me enough things to try. And I don't want to take up any more time on this subject, but I just thought you'd find this interesting. It was really a mystery to me. But thanks tremendously for that information. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the most significant thing you said tonight is that the 304 showed super Q, showed higher Q, displayed a more narrow bandwidth. No normal operation of a spectrum analyzer. Let's assume that you've got the 225 meg signal right in the center of the screen, and a little bit to the right of center, you've got the 304. And for the spectrum analyzer to suddenly act like in between the center of the screen and a little bit to the right of the screen, it suddenly jumped to a brand new resolution bandwidth filter. You cannot do that. Something really spooky is going on. I've seen that effect. And the fact that it moved one-tenth, well, you did an estimation of it moved one-tenth. When you moved up one megacycle, did it move exactly 304 to 304.100, or is that a rough estimate? Over to you, John.
I achieved getting a one-tenth read by using my markers. That's what the markers were showing me. Exactly to what percentage, I don't know, but the basic, I would say, to three figures, showed me that it was a one-tenth.
Okay, I believe. Alrighty, that's a very good technique to use the markers that way. And it moved one-tenth. That tells me the tenth harmonic of the local oscillator being used in that spectrum analyzer, the sweeping RF local oscillator going to that first mixer, is implicated. The tenth harmonic. And because the local oscillator, because your first band, I think you said, goes from 0 to 1.7 gigs. First of all, your lowest band on the spectrum analyzer, what is the low end and the high end of that first band? Is it 0 to 1.7 gigs? Go ahead.
That's correct.
Okay, 0 to 1.7 gigs. Most likely, the first IF is very close to 2 gigs. It up converts to 2 gigs. Therefore, when you're scanning through 304, the local oscillator is really on 2.304 gigs. 2.304, and the 10th harmonic of that is 23.04 gigahertz. Ho, ho, ho. I think it is a 23 gigahertz signal being generated in the mixer of the front end of that spectrum analyzer. It comes roaring out of the front panel. It's not supposed to be there because the front panel is supposed to have a roughly a 1.8 gig low-pass filter. So it should not allow the local oscillator to come squirting back out. But it's getting out of there somehow. And then the finite directivity of the Mac is allowing that signal to go to the Gigatronics and do something funny. I mean, the 10th harmonic of the LO squirting out of the front panel, going into thoroughly linear, that cannot generate a signal that comes back to the spectrum analyzer. So it's got to be going back to the Gigatronics. Therefore, when you set the Gigatronics to be 10 dB stronger in power output, which most likely it does it by changing the step attenuator in its output, that means the amount of 23 gigs that reflects off of the Gigatronics is going to change in funny ways. You're going to see some peculiar changes as you start twiddling the knobs. You've got a lot of knobs there, and you've got to stop using them. You've got to start using them. And this is a very educational process. You're going to find out an awful lot of the inner funny quirks that every...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Every signal generator and every spectrum analyzer and every network analyzer, they've all got some funny quirks. And you found one of them. So it's going to be an interesting investigation. Anything further on this one, John, before we go over to Wesley? You got it, John, K2LIW.
Dick, just one more question. So supposing I raise the output of the generator by 10 dB, and I put my attenuator at the output of the generator, and then cut in and out of that 10 dB attenuation, would that take me anywhere?
Maybe not. You've got a level control on most signal generators, which keeps the real oscillator amplifier chain at a nearly fixed power output. And then there is this very elaborate 10 dB step, 1 dB step, or F attenuator, passive device after that, that goes to the output port. So that now, assuming that the step attenuator in the Gigatronics is behaving correctly, and you decrease it by 10 dB in order to make the signal coming out of the front panel 10 decibels stronger, and now you plug in 10 decibels of extra attenuation on the outside of the Gigatronics, if I look at that whole chain, the total amount of attenuation from the final amplifier inside of Gigatronics to the final output of your network will be the same. You're just shifting where the attenuation is taking place. In theory, that shouldn't do anything. Yeah. The leveling circuit that's inside of the Gigatronics is not using the RF output port. It's using the internal signal generator output, if you know what I mean. So you might see almost no change when you do that. You might get a fraction of a dB change because of the accuracy difference between your external 10 dB pad and the internal 10 dB click, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, yes, that's fully understandable. All right. Well, I have enough things to go on, and I'll pick it up probably tomorrow. But thank you very much for the information, and to pick it up with Weston. Thanks a lot. That was a big help.
Yeah, whenever you see a signal on the spectrum analyzer that has super cube, super narrowness to it, start off immediately being suspicious of the spectrum analyzer. There's no way a signal generator can do that. If the signal generator had a true spurious signal at 304 megs, there's no way in hell that that particular setting of the spectrum analyzer could make the 304 signal out of Gigatronics appear more narrow. The laws of physics won't let you do that. But that super narrow signal, when it's a harmonic of the local oscillators inside the spectrum analyzer, oh boy, you can get signals that look too broad, look too narrow, usually too narrow, and move at funny rates. And the fact that it moves at 1/10, yeah, it's the 10th harmonic. There is something close to a 23 gigahertz signal coming out of that spectrum analyzer front panel that's doing this. And there's supposed to be a low-pass filter in the front end of that spectrum analyzer that's cutting off at roughly 1.8 gigs. It shouldn't have let that come through. However, every low-pass filter has some frequency where it re-enters. A really good 1.7 gig, 1.8 gig low-pass filter will allow everything between 0 hertz and 1.8 gigs to flow through very nicely. Then it starts rolling off. By the time it gets to 2 gigs, it's probably 50 or 60 dB down, and probably stays close to 60 dB down all the way out to 10 gigs. And the manufacturer of that filter says, hey, that's almost 10 times the frequency, the center frequency of operation. The filter doesn't re-enter in the first 10 gigahertz. That's a damn good filter. I'm going to sell it. And you have found that that filter maybe is re-entering at 23 gigahertz, because that's approximately the 10th harmonic of your local oscillator at the instant of time it scans through the signal at 304. So I think you're going to discover that it's a re-entrance phenomenon of the low-pass filter that's not supposed to not allow the local oscillator to come squirting out of the front panel. You see that process, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
KC2WGB. Yes, I do, Dick. So in other words, it's possible that spectrum analyzer could be working perfectly. It's just a fluke of nature with the combination that I'm using.
Without a doubt. Every self-respecting low-pass filter has some frequency as you go high enough where it re-enters, unless you do some very heroic things. So The low pass filter is allowing the 10th harmonic of the LO to come back out of the front panel, and your Mac may have beautiful 20 dB of coupling, just like your Alfred 20 dB of coupling, at the frequencies where they're rated, 0 to 500 megs or whatever. They have beautiful directivity, 20 dB each, but the directivity is only rated, and the coupling is only rated, for the frequency range where the coupler is rated. If the coupler is rated from 0 to 1 gig, then you're guaranteeing the performance of coupling coefficient and directivity at roughly 0 to 1 gig. But when you get up to 23 gigs, roughly 10 times higher in frequency, where the coupler was designed, its exact coupling coefficient up there at 23 gigs and its exact directivity up there can be anywhere in the world, and it's legal. It wasn't rated for that performance. Very minor differences in the internal construction allow you to start getting multipath phenomena at 23 gigs on the internal construction of that coupler itself. So, don't open up the package. Everything you own could be running into exact specification, and you could still get this because of this weird combination. You're absolutely right. And as you dig deeper into it, you're going to learn a lot more. Okay, let me drop.
What I might do, Dick, is take another spectrum analyzer and look for the 23 gigs along the line. Great. Sorry to take up so much of your time, Dick.
You did say you used a second spectrum analyzer. Or I think you did. Did you use a second spectrum analyzer? What model number and whatever you used there? Over to you, John.
Basically, it was another HP, same spectrum analyzer. I just was trying to check it and make sure I wasn't doing anything wrong, and it showed exactly the same with that spectrum analyzer also. So maybe I'll use a different spectrum analyzer and just look at the 23 gig signal.
Hold on. Yeah. I think you said your spectrum analyzer goes to 31 gigs, so you can use spectrum analyzer number one and spectrum analyzer number two and look for the 23 gig signal.
The Q is the same, the sharp Q.
There's a catch, though. For an ordinary use of the spectrum analyzer, the local oscillator is continuously scanning 30 times per second. The second spectrum analyzer, looking at the front panel of the first spectrum analyzer, is also scanning 30 sweeps per second. But no way in hell are those two scans going to be in any way synchronized. You now have a huge problem of probability of intercept.
Synchronizer.
Say again?
Have a synchronizer for HP.
No. What you want to do is you want to scan the spectrum. You want to zoom in on the 304 meg signal, the spurious signal. Zoom in on it and go to the zero scan mode. So the spectrum analyzer is sitting still looking at 304. Now, while that spectrum analyzer is sitting still, now use the second spectrum analyzer connected to the front panel of the first one and look at everything from 0 to 25 gigs, if you know what I mean. And you're going to find a weak signal of around 23 gigs, in my opinion. You see what I'm saying? You have to stop the first one on the offending frequency, stop it scanning so that the second one can find it. Otherwise, you got these two ships passing in the night, and they never see each other. Over to you, John.
Okay, that's a different tack I didn't think of. Yes, I think I'll do that. That sounds like it would be easier. Again, Dick, I'm sorry for taking so much of your time.
Now, stop worrying, John. As I see it, we're making a very good investment here. We're looking at the idiosyncrasies of very good equipment, Gigatronics and Hewlett-Packard, or Agilent, whichever brand it is. And good brands of directional couplers and so on. The RF world is strange. And if you're smart enough to know what you're looking at, there's many a time when a person will be taking data and he'll see the spurious signal. He maybe was testing Mac directional couplers. He'll see this funny signal at 304 and he'll say, well, that's just an outlier. And that's a piece of data that doesn't matter. He doesn't bother recording it and doesn't bother considering it significant. You'd be amazed how many times in history a smarter guy with curiosity says, what is that? Who's doing that? How does it get there? What makes it increase in frequency? What makes it increase in amplitude? What makes it go away? And in the process, you're learning a hell of a lot of things you never intended to. Murphy's Law or Mother Nature is teaching you a number of things simultaneously if you're curious enough to know what you're looking at and to have the curiosity to ask the question. You're doing the right thing, John. A good scientist does that. Do all the hams in Staten Island have that kind of a scientific background? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I think I'm the only kook on this island. Well, as you know, I have an extensive lab, so I have the ability to look at things that other people do not. And in fact, some come here to see these issues, and they're mesmerized also.
Yeah, don't lose your curiosity, John. Stay healthy, stay curious, and keep searching, because there's a lot of hidden information there. There's a lot of dust under the rug, and there's a lot of bugs under the rock, if you know what I mean. And if you start analyzing them, you're going to find out a whole lot of things. Okay, I told you guys about this beautiful article on magnetics, and so you're just starting to hear the beginning of what I think is going to be a breakthrough. Some of the research is going on because neodymium is an extremely valuable rare earth element, and the vast majority of all the neodymium on planet Earth appears to be located in the country of China. And China is starting to put controls on how much of their valuable neodymium they export, because they're slowly becoming, or they're rapidly becoming smart enough to realize, hey, this is a valuable rare earth element that is rare on planet Earth.
Update on that, Dick.
What'd you say, John?
Got an update on that. I don't know if you're aware of it, but there was a vast rare earth deposit found in the Pacific Ocean. Have you read about that?
Awful glad to hear that, because if China was the only supplier, and China is rapidly becoming a first world nation, if they're not already, if you know what I mean, all of a sudden they're going to be using neodymium to build all of their magnets, and they're starting to put quotas on how much they're willing to export. Therefore, the price of neodymium is about to start skyrocketing. The fact that he's discovered another great big pile of it is very good news. I vaguely remember you mentioning that a week or two ago. Give us a few more words on that, because if that hadn't happened, all of a sudden we were going to be throttled, and part of this research is going on looking at samarium, cobalt, neodymium, and other various combinations of magnetic materials, looking for something as a substitute for neodymium. And that was going to be very difficult to find, because that stuff works so darn well. So how much did they find? How hard is it to get? Give us some more words on that, John. Over to you, John, K2LRW.
WB2IKT with an update as well.
He recognized. Dick, it was found in the Pacific. I don't know if it was in the Challenger Deep or in the Abyssal Plain, but it is very deep, and there is a rest of it. They say there's going to be more there than China could imagine. They just, and they do have the technology to send the robots down to get it, but IKT may have some more information on that. Over to you, Dick.
Go right ahead, George. Tell us what you know about this one.
Oh, thank you, Dick. 2 months ago or so, May 5th, a company called Quantum Earth, Rare Earth Development of Vancouver, found a 14-square-mile deposit in Nebraska, right on the Johnson 20 county line. And it's apparently considered a gargantuan node to mine. It has neodymium, it has lanthanum, and it has niobium. And it's in Nebraska, in a little town called Elk Creek, and it's literally a huge deposit of this stuff, right in the middle of the United States.
Fantastic. Where did you read that? How did you come upon that piece of information, George?
Well, actually, I get a news feed that's called Slashdot, and it was a Slashdot article, and Slashdot is one of the better quality feeds in terms of they usually have a link to the original source. And in this case, the original source is kind of an online blog called New Energy and Fuel, and dates back to May of this year.
Yeah, well done. My son, Chris, KB2IKT, listens to Slashdot or signs into that periodically. good data there. That's very good news. And so I'm a little bit amazed that this article in the August issue of IEEE's proceedings didn't mention those recent finds of neodymium and other rare earth metals. So that's that decreases some of the panic with reference to the rareness of or the degree of difficulty of getting a hold of neodymium. Boy, the strength of some of these magnets that John and Wesley have been experimenting with, wow. Or you just take apart somebody's discarded disk drive, you take it apart and you start taking those magnets out of there. Particularly the pair of magnets that operate the movable arm that moves the head across the disk. Boy, are they potent. Wow. So there are magnets and there are magnets. And so these super strong magnets that were going into the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer that's now on the International Space Station. For a bunch of reasons, they had to switch over from cryogenics into regular magnets in order to get longevity out of that instrument. And if they had some of these newer magnets that are under development that have twice the magnetic field, they would have less enthusiasm for trying to make something cryogenic and worrying about having the helium to boil off in order to maintain the cryogenic. The total cost of the helium, let me drop this. The total cost of the helium that goes into the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, that's in CERN right now, Switzerland. They're using, I think they're the biggest consumer of liquid helium in order to maintain the cryogenics. So as we start developing better and better magnets, that very high degree of difficulty of maintaining cryogenic characteristics to get superconductivity becomes a lot easier to achieve. So good things are happening. Now, the very first thing that was on Wesley's list was this YouTube video where a guy has a... I got the wrong list. When did I put that list? The very first thing on that list was this guy lighting up a halogen lamp with his fingers across it and doing it underwater. Well, if you build a Tesla coil, let me drop.
I think was that halogen or quartz lamp?
I'm not sure, but it almost doesn't matter. Let me show you what I'm talking about now. There's a zillion different ways of building a Tesla coil. The way you build the highest power Tesla coil that anyone's ever done it is to start off with a Volpig transformer fit backwards, and you've got, let me pick a number, 13 kilovolts going across a really potent spark gap, and you're putting 1,000 ampere spikes into the primary of your Tesla coil, and you can get some really god-awful voltages out of that secondary. That's one way of doing it. The friendliest way I've ever seen to build a Tesla coil is the one that my buddy built when I was a youngster. He really built a sweep tube oscillator running at something like 300 kilohertz or 200 kilohertz. So he's got this sine wave oscillator with a power tube producing the waveform that went into the primary of the Tesla coil. Out of the secondary came a very nice secondary high voltage that you could easily put your fingers near it, put your fingers on it. You saw the sparks go over to your finger, and you felt almost nothing because of the high frequency, 100 kilohertz or 300 kilohertz, whatever it was, and because of the skin effect, all of the current is flowing along the skin of my finger, not going through the penetration, and therefore I didn't feel it. So if someone had built a sine wave, high frequency, something like a Tesla coil, and used that as the voltage applied to the two terminals of this halogen or quartz-like lamp, and even though the lamp itself was getting the right voltage to light up, because the voltage was high enough in frequency that when you put your fingers across it, the skin effect means that the voltage was not penetrating your finger, and therefore, instead of the usual definition of high voltage, anything over 50 volts is considered high voltage as far as human lethality is concerned.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Over 50 volts, there's a significant probability that the signal flowing from your left hand to the right hand going through your chest could send your heart into fibrillation, and you and I would call that electrocution. that the voltage is flowing between my pinky and my index finger of my right hand, although it would be damn uncomfortable, it's nowhere near as lethal. But if now I'm making the frequency high enough so that the current is flowing across my skin and not penetrating the body at all of a sudden 50 volts is no longer lethal. So the definition of high voltage and potentially lethal voltages change considerably depending on the nature of the frequency components of the signal. So I think that's part of what's going on. Assuming that that particular YouTube video was not a hoax, assuming that's really a real experiment that somebody is conducting, then that's my guess as to what you might be seeing. What do you think on that one, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW?
N2XJN, yes, I think the same. But there was another hoax. I've seen it many times in different kind of videos. And people were trying to, some of the people, not this guy, this guy is a serious guy. We're trying to relate it to cold electricity whatsoever. I agree with that. Now we have a long piece of stuff, so I could go more quicker through that. The point number one is the introduction to YIG, Y-I-G, tuned oscillator. Now, when you see the green questions, green color is assigned to the questions. Now, on the picture, on the right-hand side, you see the YIG oscillator, which says 0 to 0.3 to 3.5 gigahertz. And a question of mine was, why the frequency on the picture shows 0 to 3.5 gigahertz? Does it mean that YIG can tune lower than gigahertz? Okay.
Yeah, I've used a bunch of YIG filters and YIG oscillators. And above roughly 1.8 gigs, they behave very nicely. There's something funny about the way the YIG material behaves with normal doping, where it becomes extremely nonlinear below roughly 1.8 gigs. I forget what they called that particular frequency, but it's got a fancy name. The YIG material itself really doesn't want to go below 1.8 gigs unless you dope it in a funny way. If you add other materials to the recipe by which you built those YIG spheres. I've used YIG filters that go all the way down to, I think it was 800 megacycles, but they behave very differently. And they've got some crazy nonlinear characteristics when strong signals go through. You pay the price. You can force the YIG to work below 1.8 gigs by doing some fancy doping, but it's nowhere near as pure a material in its resonance phenomena. So the exact mechanism by which below 1.8 gig stops operating as a YIG, I'm not sure, but I have personally witnessed that on Avantech YIG oscillators, YIG tuned oscillators, and YIG Tech bandpass filters. So YIG Tech bandpass filters and Avantech YIG tuned oscillators, I used a whole lot of them on the spectrum analyzers we were manufacturing in the 70s, and you really didn't like the way they behaved below 1.8 gig. OUS, K2RIW.
Yes, ma'am, I understand that the number on the right-hand side picture from 0 to 3.5 gigahertz is simply that showing the direction from which the frequencies increase, but not really showing that it's starting from zero.
You said right-hand side. Now, is this a particular website that's under question number one? Or question,
you have a point in the questioning, and you have a pictures attached. You can see these pictures right now, right from the email.
Yeah, I had to open my HTM message phenomena for that to be done. Okay, an introduction to YIG tuned oscillator, and I'm looking at
the right picture. You see on the picture, 0 to 3.5 gigahertz.
Okay, my machine is a little bit slow. The first picture under item number one showed up right away. The second picture showed up a little bit later. And I think you're saying there's a third picture that I have to wait for.
No, just the second picture. You have a picture on the left-hand side and a picture on the right-hand side in my screen. A picture on the right-hand side, you see the same YIG oscillator as you see on the first picture, but from different perspective, and it says on a 0 to 3.5 gigahertz.
Okay. Are we led to believe that YIG oscillator puts out a signal anywhere between 0 and 3.5 gigs. Is that what you're saying?
No, but the assumption would be like that. You say it doesn't go lower. My understanding would be then that 0 to 3.5 gigahertz is just the direction that it shows on the body of the Teague oscillator, showing that this is how it's being increased. But it goes to maximum to 3.5 gigahertz. But the 0 does not represent 0. Back to you.
And that black tag saying 0-3.5 gigahertz on that black tag, if that was put there by the Yig oscillator manufacturer, that would suggest it does put out that frequency range. If it is a heterodyne function, in other words, if it really is a Yig-tuned oscillator that's running from 2 to 5.5 gigahertz, and it's got a local oscillator built in that is mixing the signal down to 0 to 3.5 gigs, that is possible. And I may have chosen the wrong numbers, but you see what I mean. If it's a heterodyne type device with a fixed oscillator mixing with the real Yig oscillator that's running above 2 gigs, we'll say, you could definitely do that. You could, with mixing, produce a 0 to 3 gig oscillator, just like the very first band on many of the spectrum analyzers really does scan essentially 0 to 2 gigs. That's a lot of octaves. It's not really doing it directly. It's doing it by up conversion, whereas this Yig oscillator could be doing it by down conversion. So that black tag could be telling you the truth if it's a heterodyne device. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Okay. The heart of Yig tuned oscillator is the Yig sphere. And the Yig iridium iron garnet. No, it's not the iridium. It's ethereum. The spheres are manufactured from the synthetic crystalline structure, which is grown in platinum crucibles. And the question is, what is that?
Okay, I may be pronouncing it wrong, but I always thought Yig was yttrium iron garnet. When you have the right cleanliness, the right proportions of those three atoms, you mix them together in a crucible. You mix them together in with very high temperature characteristics, and you make these crystals, and you, with a very complicated process, make that crystal into an extremely precise round sphere. And then you take that sphere, and with careful measurement, you find out where its crystal orientation exists, and you glue that Yig sphere on the end of a plastic rod with a very precise orientation on that plastic rod. Then you take that plastic rod, you shove it through the side of a magnetic structure, you push it into the middle of the magnetic structure where the electromagnet, you've got a solenoid coil, and where the pole pieces come together with an air gap, the Yig sphere is put right in the middle of that air gap. Also coincident with that air gap are is a turn of wire, a piece of enameled wire, and the piece of enameled wire is in the form of a circle, where the enameled wire doesn't quite go 360 degrees. It goes 355 degrees, we'll say. And you've got a circle of wire in the XY plane, you've got a circle of wire in the YZ plane, they're at right angles to each other, and they're around that Yig sphere. Now, ordinarily, those two nearly one-turn coils of wire are exactly at right angles to each other, and at microwave frequencies, they have zero coupling. You carefully position those two coils, those one-turn coils, so they're at right angles, and they are orthogonal, and they are isolated. They might have
repeater, timeout, cancel.
They might have 40 decibels of isolation between the two, and in the middle of those two right-angle coils is this Yig sphere. And ordinarily, the Yig sphere is put in the geometric center, and it doesn't change the orthogonality. Those two coils are still at right angles to each other. But now you put a strong magnetic field across that Yig sphere, and the magnetic moment of that material precesses. Depending on the strength of the magnetic field, precession of that magnetic field takes place inside the Yig sphere. And if you can make that precession occur at, let me pick a number, 2.0 gigahertz, then for the first time, the signal you put into coil number one, the little half-turn coil, one-turn coil, will couple into coil number two,